Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with stock markets around the world tumbling following what is being called Black Monday on the Shanghai Exchange, after which, as the opening bell sounded, the New York Stock Exchange plunged over 1,000 points in its biggest nosedive ever, as the DAX, the FTSE, and other markets around the world also tanked. A former investment banker at Goldman Sachs, Wallace Turberville, joins us to discuss the global contagion of falling prices as investors hedge against predictions of slower growth in China that is driving down oil prices and raising concerns about China's economic stability. Then we'll look into the consequences for the millions of Americans with 401k retirement accounts that are subject to the turbulence of the stock market since, for the past 30 years, corporate America has shed itself of the more stable and secure defined benefit pensions obligations and rewarded Wall Street, who charge higher fees while delivering lower returns with vulnerable 401k plans. Scott Klinger, the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government, who previously worked as a security analyst and a portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management, joins us to discuss how Americans' retirement security was gutted by moving workers into privatized 401k-style accounts. Then finally, with the recent announcement by the Los Angeles Police Department that its officers should no longer see themselves as warriors against crime, but as guardians watching over communities, we will speak with award-winning investigative journalist and author Joe Dominic. He is the Associate Director of the Center on Media, Crime and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and we will discuss the rash of police shootings and the cries for justice from groups like Black Lives Matter in the context of police reform and Joe's latest book, Blue, the LAPD and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. And joining us now is Wallace Turberville, a senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wallace Turberville.
I'm happy to be joining you.
So that must mean then, Wally, that you don't have a lot of money tied up in the stock market.
Well, I'm happy to be joining you, but I'm not so happy about the stock market.
So, I mean, there was the Black Monday on the Shanghai Exchange, and then as soon as the sounding bell rang on the New York Stock Exchange, it took a plunge of, what, about 1,083 or something? Isn't this the biggest plunge in history?
The biggest absolute plunge, yes. I mean, it was quite a moment when the market opened this morning, down 1,000 points. The difference, of course, is in 1988, in one day the stock market fell 22%, which was but it's much smaller absolute amount in 88 because, of course, the index is much higher now. It's quite a bit higher than it was in 88, but it was down almost 10% at that point.
So how much is this a result of a kind of global contagion that starts out in Shanghai and travels around the world?
Well, in one sense, it's 100% related, but of course, like many things, there are greater complexities, and there's a lot going on in the world today. And I'm sure there will be some that will say that this has to do with the Federal Reserve's suggestion that interest rates here are going to go up in September. But I think the by far the best analysis on the events of not just today, but what's happened since last Wednesday. So don't forget that Thursday and Friday and even Wednesday of last week were very, very tough days on the market as well. So that almost all of that is the proximate cause, if you will, as I say in law, is what's going on in China. But it's a very complicated set of circumstances.
Well, let's try and go through those complicated circumstances. We're told that China's economy is slowing, and these predictions are causing particularly oil prices to drop. It's also raised speculation since there have been a number of devaluations, and an apparent inability of the Chinese government to get its hands around its own economy or its own speculators, that China's economy itself may not be as stable as it was once thought. So is that at the heart of it?
That's very much at the heart of it. And don't leave out the fact that China picked an interesting time to accede to American protestations that they had controlled their currency too much and decided to let the currency float a bit. And, of course, it floated down so that it made our currency high relative to theirs, which would increase their imports to us. And, in effect, they would export their unemployment and perhaps even some of their other troubles in the direction of the U.S. and Europe. So that was a part of it, too. So China's got issues on many fronts.
Well, I guess, though, the drop in oil prices, which is, again, apparently related to China, because the assumption is that its economy will slow and therefore it won't have so much demand for energy. But that's a mixed blessing, isn't it? It certainly is not good for Russia and Venezuela and a number of countries that are resource dependent. But on the other hand, surely it's good for the American consumer, isn't it?
It's good for the American consumer for certain, not necessarily for workers and oil, but oil is a fundamental price of almost everything that we buy. So as the oil price goes down, that means that products here will be cheaper. There'll be more scope for, in theory, raising salaries, although that hasn't really happened so far, much as it should have, for certain. But, yeah, generally speaking, that's good. On the other hand, it does mean that, again, this is the complexity of this thing is amazing, it does mean that since the Chinese currency is lower in value, they'll be buying less from the United States and less from Germany, for instance, and exporting more, which could have an adverse effect on salaries on the other end. So there's a rebalancing that's going on. It's a little bit like we won't know how to solve the Rubik's Cube until we do some more turning around, I don't think.
And again, I'm speaking with Wallace Turberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee. So you mentioned that the Fed sort of signaled that it's going to stop quantitative easing and that it may allow interest rates to rise, that may be also a big trigger. Walk us through that, if you will, Wally.
Yeah, what they suggested was a rise in interest rates as a first step. Quantitative easing, backing off, would come a bit later, in theory. And that there's been a little bit of a kabuki dance, if you will, over when that's going to occur, because there are multiple opinions on the Fed. One of the questions that will be raised going forward, undoubtedly has been raised in some circles already, is whether the interest rate rise, it's really designed to try to address the fact that the economy has got some problems still that are lurking that would actually benefit from a bit of a rise in the interest rate, as long as it doesn't squeeze off growth. Now, with what's gone on with China and the stock market and the elimination of about $5 trillion of wealth on a worldwide basis in the last couple of days, there is some concern whether the interest rate rise is now not achievable for a while. The notion was that The hints were all about in September that we'd see the first rise in interest rates. Now, this is an interesting problem because, let's say, we are exactly where we are right now. We're in those circumstances, say, a few months from now, and the China situation and the emerging market situation causes there to be another recession, which is not out of the question. We're in our seventh year of expansion, not in incomes, but in terms of corporate profitability. Right now, the short-term treasury rate, last time I checked, it was about 0.3%, almost to zero. So there's not much that the Fed can do in terms of lowering interest rates. And they've done so much quantitative easing, which is buying long-term bonds from banks to put cash into the system. One of the concerns is that if all of this is a matter, it's sort of a domino effect, was to lead to a recession, what in the heck would we do to resist the recession? So there is, this gives you a sense of why we do need to come off of where we've been in terms of interest rates and very, very, very low inflation. To be healthy, the economy needs to have a little bit more inflation and a little bit more in terms of interest rates out there, and we're not there. And if this puts that off, that's got its own problems. But the stock market has been responsive in the past to the fear of interest rate rise. It's just clear, it's just abundantly clear that that's not really what's driving what's going on right now. For instance, the German stock market was off much worse, and they're far more exposed to China. So as an example, this isn't really about the Fed and interest rates. This is about China. But it could put the Fed off of its interest rate policy, which it needs to start implementing at some point to give us a little breathing room.
And while Somerville, the New York Stock Exchange today invoked a rarely used Rule 48, which allows stocks to open without any price indications. Tell me about that. What was the point of that?
Well, I think the sense was that there needed to be pressure relieved from the system. It was pretty clear. It was really clear. I was following things. I was up pretty early this morning, speaking to some folks in Europe over the phone. So I was following things pretty carefully from about 6:30 this morning on the Eastern time, and it was pretty clear that there was pressure built up. And even though there was no price, if you will, on some stocks, the decision was made to let the pressure off, because I think restraining the pressure that had built up by the time the New York Stock Exchange opened this morning was problematic. The other thing, of course, is that stocks trade on so many different venues now. For some reason, the SEC decided that was a good idea a few years back to create more competition. It actually creates all kinds of wild things that could happen. But the point being, stocks would be traded somewhere, and I think that was. The management decided that was a good idea.
Well, today would indicate the otherwise, wouldn't it? What's your sense of the overall record on that, or the overall ledger, if you will?
Of letting it go?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a fair question as to where would it have gone otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, that's I think that's a fairly, I personally have the view that, maybe because I was listening to it so carefully this morning, but I personally have the view that it was going to be very hard to constrain otherwise. I think it's important to note that there are lots of different venues where stocks can move around, but it certainly did crater at the beginning. But that was, I think that was, a lot of that was built into it, and I think constraining it might have actually, under today's circumstances, been counterproductive.
But what did cause it to go back up?
I think there's always a sentiment that people buy on the dips, or try to. And I think there was just a trend, kind of a buying. Of course, the stock market did move higher to something. There was down only about 170 points, I believe, at one point, and then went back down to close well over 600 points down. So the volatility was just incredible. And I think a lot of it has to do with just big money taking positions, trying to get out ahead of movements, and that, which is a very volatile situation. And the market's been unbelievably volatile since Wednesday of last week. So I think there was a lot of money moving in and out, probably some dumb money moving in and out too, frankly.
But what role would high-speed trading play in this? Is high-speed trading able to ride out these things?
Because Oh, no. Well, high-speed trading would... Okay, so in some of the volatility undoubtedly has to do with high-speed trading, by the way. I'm a huge opponent of high-speed trading, because what happens is that directional kinds of events can be exacerbated by high-speed traders, people who have computer programs that execute trades in a very, very rapid manner and can move from buyers to sellers to buyers very quickly. Undoubtedly, there was some effect of that. I think probably the around the margins, especially some of the internal volume of volatility that happened, was had to do with trading and high-speed trading. I think that I've got to be, I mean, to be perfectly frank about it, I've got to believe that the scope of what happened today was a wave that, while high-speed trading might have had something to do with some of the directional movements during the day, I'm quite sure high-speed traders either made a lot of money or some went out of business today. But the directional movement is something that's bigger than that, and is something that's of larger concern. I think that there was fundamentally the issues people have with what's going on in China and in how China reacts to or relates to the rest of the emerging markets is a fairly legitimate thing and something to be concerned about. So I think high-speed trading had a lot to do with the internal moves, like the bounce that happened today or the how much it bounced and then how much it fell again. But I think the big thematic issue of the sell-off has a lot to do with what's going on in China. It's got a lot to do with what people are realizing about the fragility of the U.S. and whether we really are in a good position to weather storms. There's so much. I mean, the Fed has had to fight the situation over the last few years so strongly, and so much of the Fed liquidity went in right directly into the banks, as opposed to into the real economy. That we just aren't where we should be, and I think I think underlying a lot of this is a concern. The fragility is reflected in where the Fed is.
So is that to say then that we have as a country an investment in China's economic stability?
I think that we are exposed to China's economic stability, which is not a great place to be. I think that since we've invested so little in ourselves, in effect, a lot of what's happened is that a lot of the balance sheet of the United States is, if you will, sort of shifted to China, and honestly, even infrastructure. we do so little to invest in ourselves now because of austerity and because U.S. corporations are so, they fetishize so much the short-term movement of stock values that the numbers prove it out, we don't invest in the expansion of things that business in the United States that creates jobs. That's why incomes have lagged so much. So since we haven't done that, and since China's been growing at, you know, double-digit rates, it's clear that there's been this shift. And the shift is problematic. Not so much a problem that China's grown as the problem that we haven't. And so we're very exposed. If U.S. assets, meaning, you know, real businesses employing real people in the U.S. were more robust, then we wouldn't be as exposed to what's going on other places. I mean, you know, it'd be a setback, but I think it's more of a concerning setback now.
Well, there's no question that the extraordinary investment in infrastructure going on in China and across the stands all the way to the Indian Ocean and Pakistan into Russia is breathtaking. High-speed rail, oil pipelines compared to the United States, where with all-time low interest rates, it's criminal that we haven't improved our roads and bridges and rails. It's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Oh, it's totally mind-boggling. And you know, I mean, it's bad enough that those jobs haven't happened here, and it's bad enough that those kinds of things put our commerce at risk. But one must remember, I guess, that much of infrastructure has to do with things like climate change. So we've put ourselves at grave risk in a lot of different ways by simply not investing in the asset base of this country. And so, I mean, I lay all of that at the feet of how we've become so enslaved to the trading market mantra. I mean, I sort of date it all back to 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. But I think we're seeing sort of the back end of that now, which is really problematic. And we're in a I just have my fingers crossed that we don't fall off into recession, because I actually don't know what happens if you can't reduce interest rates. And you know, zero is, you can't go below zero. We can't go below zero, but we've never done that before. So who the hell knows what, you know, what the outcome of that would be. But we really don't have the tools right now to sort of withstand any sort of shock. And I don't know what we would do. Of course, you could always, you know, Congress could always decide to start spending money on infrastructure, but I don't see that. Do you?
No, I don't. And I thank you. I thank you for joining us, Wallace Tuberville.
I'm happy to talk to you. I wish it was under happier circumstances, as they say.
Right. And again, I've been speaking with Wallace Tuberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodities Future Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee. We're going to take a brief station break, back looking into how retirement accounts are at risk on the stock exchange.
It's the money.
You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break down. I never give you my number.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He is a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And just following on from Wallace Tuberville's analysis of today's dramatic turbulence and plunge on the New York stock market, not to mention all around the world, do you buy his notion that we have a very fragile economy here in the United States? We've invested so little in ourselves, particularly our infrastructure, and that the Fed has spent all this time basically pouring all of its liquidity into the banks and not into the economy, that if we were to face another recession, which is to some extent due, but given the cycles, we don't have any tools.
Well, I think that's right on the money. I think that the government has supported the banks, as your previous guest said, and we've also had this pressure, austerity pressure in Congress to not fund programs to help families get ahead and get better jobs and get better training. We have young people who have massive amounts of debt from going to college, first generation that's had those levels of debt from college. And we have corporations sitting on trillions of dollars of cash, in many cases because they don't want to pay taxes on it. So they've found ways to squirrel their profits away offshore. So we have a very underinvested economy. I think it's quite weak, and I think the stock market's been masked quite a bit, the rise in the stock market, because When corporations do spend, what they're buying is their own stock. And so they're buying back their stock and making the earnings per share seem larger than they really are. And that's been driving the market higher.
So why would you have an economy like this? What is wrong with our leaders in this country? Why would they allow the American people to be shortchanged in this basic way?
Well, I think there's a lot of fear going on. I think the corporations are stoking a lot of fear to try and get more tax cuts for businesses. I do a fair amount of lobbying on Capitol Hill, and one of the things I hear all the time from both Republican offices and Democratic offices is that our corporations aren't competitive, which up until the last few weeks has been very hard to think about when stock markets are hitting record highs and corporate profits have been at record highs and our CEOs make more than any other CEOs in the world. But they've bought this notion that the way to prosperity is more tax cuts for rich individuals and prosperous corporations. And even if that means not investing in communities and having crummy roads and bridges and schools that are leaking that our kids can't learn in and all sorts of infrastructure problems that we have.
Well, it is I suspect a lot of this has to do with the power of money in politics, doesn't it? If you have that kind of mindset amongst the power elite, and if they can basically buy the politicians that they want, little wonder that there's this restiveness out there in the land. Donald Trump phenomenon, the inchoate anger on the right, and the burgeoning support for Bernie Sanders on the left, who is taking on the 1%.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's unfortunate because in times past, people have taken control of the government. This isn't the first time we've had government by the elites. We had this 100 years ago. We had it in the run-up to the Great Depression. And, we've had other points in time. But the people seem to have too often turned on the government rather than thinking the way to solve this is for us to elect people that represent our interests and not interests that are in contrast to ours or adversarial to ours.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, who's the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He is a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a Security Analyst and Portfolio Manager for Walden Asset Management. So with the about $10 trillion being wiped off the global stock markets since June, let's talk about the vulnerability of retirement funds on Wall Street. It's no secret that for the past 30 years, there's been a trend where Americans' secured defined benefit pensions, which are much more stable, that obligation has corporate America has effectively shed that obligation over the past 30 years and rewarded Wall Street with these 401ks which charge higher fees and deliver lower returns and of course are much more vulnerable. So what was behind the gutting of America's pension system?
Well, I think corporations saw that the workforce was aging. They were having this liability they didn't want to save for. It's very interesting. General Electric was a company that for many years reported record profits every year, and they were not putting a dime into their retirement accounts as the markets moved higher. They kept using legal accounting practices to say that they were making enough gain in the stock market to offset what they would owe, what the money they were supposed to put in to the pension fund. And then lo and behold, when the market turned south in 2008 or 2009, they said, oh, we're going to have to put money in now. Let's just close it down or let's shut it to new members. And I think we saw that throughout corporate America. As long as the markets were rising and they didn't have to pay anything, they let it go. But as soon as it cost them something, they disbanded that and went the way of defined contribution plans, 401ks and 403bs and those kinds of things, which put all of the risk on the workers. So, 30 years ago, a market hiccup like this might have been a worry that people might not have their job if it became bad enough. But tonight, now we have a double whammy of people worrying about their retirement savings as well.
But you don't have to be an economist to understand that a large pool of money invested by professionals will yield far greater returns than small separate accounts managed by individuals with no professional training in finance. So, you know,
well, there's also enormous fees. There's fees, and most people have their 401ks and mutual funds, which, you know, you have the overall fees, and then the funds and the fees on the funds, and then insurance company sells you have insurance fees, and it can run into, you know, several percent of which goes to Wall Street and not into the American workers' pockets.
So was that the deal, that corporate America essentially rewarded Wall Street, because Wall Street obviously micromanages corporate America, don't they? They demand profits all the time.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think, you know, coupled with the fact that the companies could get out from under the shouldering the risk, then being able to pass it off to their workers is the other obviously big reason in that change.
So what do we know about the hit taken today by the average American who has a 401k?
Well, it's pretty substantial. I mean, it wiped out the gains for the year and into last year, and especially people who are approaching near retirement, we don't know how fast it will come back, if it will come back. So it's not insignificant. And, you know, I think, you know, I remember I'm in my mid-50s when I was a kid, you know, you heard the Dow Jones average at the end of the day. And usually it was up by a small number or down by a small number. Now it's reported every 10 minutes and people take interest because their future financial security depends on it. And that's a pretty difficult place to be as a country.
So as someone who's worked as a security analyst and a portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management, what would your advice be, and what alternatives do people have from these Wall Street 401ks?
Well, I for many years have kept my 401k in CDs at a community development bank. I do that because it's investing in the real economy. It's investing in people's mortgages and small businesses in moderate and low-income communities, and it's government insured through the Credit Union Association. And so, my returns are maybe 3% a year, but in times like this, I sleep well at night. I don't worry about what's happening in the stock market. I did an interesting experiment. My daughter is now 26. When she was a baby, I saved the same amount of money for her each year. I put some of it in a community development CD, and I put the other half in the stock market. And by the time she turned 18 and went to college, the two pools were virtually identical in size. One rose and fell, the market one, and the other one grew steadily, kind of a tortoise and a hare story. But that was my experience over 15 or 16 years, a long-term part of the stock market. So I think there are alternatives. I think the government should do more to encourage people to invest in the real economy and not have to play the Wall Street casino game that's run by Wall Street.
Well, it's run by Wall Street, but to some extent it's also rigged by Wall Street, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yep.
I mean, we're talking earlier about
more so. Now it's computers that are doing most of the trading. Various estimates between half and three quarters of the trades in the market are computer generated, and a lot of them are the high frequency traders that aren't really investing. They're just interested in making fractions of a penny on every trade, and that increases volatility and makes days like today even worse.
So I was going to mention that because we were talking about that earlier, about high street trading and the extent to which it may have played a role. Certainly, if you have an economy, and we know that our economy is becoming increasingly financialized. It's up to about 60%, isn't it?
Yep, something like that.
So on top of that, you have this high-speed trading, which is just about churning money, it's all about extracting wealth, not creating wealth, which was the original idea in capitalism. I'm wondering how much that this is about just sort of manipulating money, and it's so unproductive, but yet it's so dominant. You can't break this grip, right? This is where the political clout in the country is in Wall Street, and this is why there's such an underinvestment in America and in the real economy, because these guys own our politicians, and they basically they run the casino, they own the casino, they've rigged the casino. So what can we do?
Well, we need some alternatives, right? So, you know, there's trillions of dollars. Americans have trillions of dollars in their financial retirement accounts. Where else can that money go if not Wall Street? Let's start to develop some of these other vehicles. Congress every 2 months has a fight about rebuilding highways and bridges. There's a lot more infrastructure that needs rebuilding than just highways and bridges. We know our water lines, our sewer lines, our kids' schools are all in less than optimal shape and need a big investment. Why don't we think about some sort of government bond that people can buy in their retirement accounts that would be for infrastructure, that would earn a guaranteed return, we'd pay back with our tax dollars. We'd be investing in our country, not investing in something that we have no idea what it is. I mean, most people own mutual funds and have no idea what stocks are in them, or if they do learn, by the time they learn, there could be different stocks because Wall Street turns over and trades stocks so quickly. So we really need some more imaginative thinking than the only thing we can do is to shovel more money into Wall Street's hands.
So is there anybody, frankly, this is the first time I've heard of that idea, and it's a brilliant idea to, you know.
Well, you know, in the Second World War, we sold victory bonds as a way to finance the war effort. I'm not necessarily eager to fund wars, but, you know, people can decide to do things together, and we have a lot of wealth.
So, but my question to you, though, Scott Klingler, is who's in our government and our policymakers just talking about these kind of ideas? Are we just completely dependent on Wall Street?
Yeah, as I said, I don't think there's very much imagination. And I even go into the offices of progressive Democrats and I hear the same thing about how can we keep our corporations healthy. It doesn't look to me when I look around at the real world that the corporations are the ones that's suffering, and even ones that may be facing some challenges are still doing a lot better than the average families that I talk to.
So we need a champion then. You should write a policy paper then, Scott, for Bernie Sanders.
Well, I think some of the contest, political contest, is talking about some reasonable things.
Right.
One of the things Senator Sanders is talking about is getting corporations to pay their taxes on their offshore earnings and stop this game that costs the U.S. Treasury $90 billion a year of selling things in the United States and figuring out a way to create a paper transaction to make it seem like your profits were earned in Luxembourg or Ireland. That's got to stop. That didn't used to be. That wasn't the way things were in the 60s or 70s. It's largely an advent of internet and the ability to transfer funds and make transactions at the speed of light, even when they're not real transactions, no physical goods are moving. And so we know how to close these things. It's the political will, and it's the people not insisting that their leaders do the right thing.
But just in this, in the context of what happened today, this seems like a no-brainer. And on top of that, what Wally Turberville was talking about, how fragile our economy is, how we've not, you know, the Fed has invested its liquidity into the banks, not into the economy.
Right.
And we've invested so little in ourselves, and our infrastructure is crumbling. That all of that, that's a kind of perfect storm. In other words, this is a clear and present danger that, you know, we could have a recession that the Fed is simply incapable of pulling any more levers.
Yeah, there's no more room to lower interest rates, for sure. You know, one of the worrisome things about China that I didn't hear your whole interview with your previous guest, but the fact is that commodity prices, including oil, are likely to keep going down, which, you know, sounds like a good thing in terms of being able to fill up your car for less money. But it also creates a lot of incentive to do the right things in terms of conserving energy and building more efficient homes and offices and investing in renewable things and things that will get us out of long-term dependence on fossil fuels. So there's lots of downsides in what's going on in the world. Some of them are in financial markets and some of them are in our homes and our communities.
Well, Scott Klingler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Klingler, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a Security Analyst and Portfolio Manager for Walden Asset Management. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into police reform amid cries for justice from groups like Black Lives Matter.
Outside the patient millions. them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, betting, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding axes.
Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, cause you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, cause we be getting hyped to the sound of the police.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Joe Dominic, an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and the Associate Director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's the author of To Protect and Serve, the LAPD's Century of War in the City of Dreams, which won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Nonfiction Book, and Cruel Justice, Three Strikes and the Politics of Crime in America's Golden State. His latest book just out is Blue, the LAPD and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Dominic.
Pleasure to be here. Yeah.
And before we get into the book, because clearly this is an important book, it comes at an important time because you're really talking about a police force here in Los Angeles. As you say, it was basically a reactionary paramilitary force under Parker and then Crazy Ed Davis and then Darryl Gates, and now it's a whole different police force. And so it serves as a model for the rest of the country, which we know is beset by these constant...
Well, I actually wouldn't go that far, Ian. I think that the LABD is a much better department than it used to be post-Bill Bratton and post the federal consent decree, but I certainly don't think that in some ways it's a model for other police departments. In terms of community policing, really innovative, done a lot of good things. Charlie Beck, who's the current chief, was the chief of the South Bureau. He instigated one of the best community policing operations in the country. That's starting to slip, and we see in the LAPD, an astounding number of shootings, 25 thus far this year, 13 people dead. Many of these people were unarmed and were involved in shootings that are the kind of shootings where you say, holy cow, I can't believe I just saw that.
Right.
So I think the LAPD still has a ways to go. So,
well, what I meant, though, was that the fact that they at least reform from those early days, and so much of the country, police forces apparently haven't been reformed. They haven't at least undergone the process.
Right.
Not that it's complete by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, the Police Executive Research Forum, which is a research and policy group whose members include the commanders from the largest U.S. police departments, have just come out with a report that basically says that all of these controversial police shootings, and we've just had another one in St. Louis, could have been avoided even though they have been considered legally justified. And according to Chuck Wexler, the executive director of this group, he wrote that there have been missed opportunities to ratchet down the encounter, to slow things down, to call in additional resources. And the report found that sometimes these things are considered as antithetical to traditional police cultures. So you have this apparently recognition on the part of the Police Executive Forum that police are being essentially taught to shoot first and negotiate later, and they've got to turn that equation around.
Well, changing the culture of a police department is a long-term project. It takes very, very strong leadership. It takes new ideas, and it takes a police chief who sees himself as at the top of a lot of constituencies, his or her police department, poor communities of color, affluent people, commercial people, et cetera. And it's a difficult balancing act. And I don't think that most police departments have begun to really recognize that and be able to act on that. So what we have been seeing, really, since the fugitive slave laws in the 1850s, is a way of treating poor people and a way of, in particular, treating poor people of color in a brutal fashion to kind of beat them down and make sure that they don't rise above their station and they stay in their place.
Well, that seemed to be the case with Sandra Bland down in Texas. Mm-hmm. It's like she just spoke out like a white person might, but no, she was black. And I'm not suggesting that she was necessarily murdered in the jail, but from making an illegal, not, you know, without using your indicators to take a move to a right-hand lane, you end up dead. There's something right. wrong with that picture.
Oh, yeah. And that's one of the problems is that we're incredibly over-policed in America, that we pride ourselves as being civil libertarians and, you know, for as much freedom as we can possibly have. And yet we're probably among the most over-policed countries in the world. And this particular case that you're speaking of was a great example. You know, I saw that video, and what I saw was this cop barreling down the road, and she moves over to let him pass. And he stops her for not using and there were no cars around her, for not using signal as he went into the other lane. So that's just very typical of the kind of stop and frisk and broken windows policing that has been used to an absurd extent. And it's nothing new, but it really became used in a massive way starting in the 90s with the war on drugs and the war on crimes and some of Bill Bratton's innovations that did not work out so well.
And again, I'm joined in the studio by Joe Dominic, an award-winning investigative journalist and author and the associate director of the Center for Media, Crime and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's the author of a number of important bestsellers on policing, the latest of which just out is Blue, the LAPD and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. But without suggesting that we're in a brave new world here, things have gotten better, but they've still got a long way to go. That also surely applies to the other big police force here in the Southern California, and that is the LA Sheriff's Office, who have had a kind of, God, how would you describe the jail system? It's been some of the most cruel and brutal stuff that's been going on. It's been systematic.
It's like,
and they had the most, the decades of cover-up, and finally they get rid of Lee Barker with the FBI's help. And apparently this guy, McDonald, who you also write about in Blue, is trying to, there's a new sheriff in town, right? He's mm-hmm. trying to clean it up. Isn't that happening? And they just were talking about how they might consider different treatment of the mentally ill who have been treated sadistically.
Yeah, well, you know, the men's central jail is really Abu Ghraib West and has been for many years. And it's remarkable that it's taken the feds so long. They've been involved, but they've never been deeply involved until recently. And it was just a disgrace. That whole department really needs serious revamping. And in particular, the jails. You know, when you take a young man or a young woman and as their first assignment, when you become a sheriff, you have to spend 5 years as a jailer, you know,
right,
with people who are miserable, who are in miserable conditions, and who are angry and violent, and it really
and mentally ill,
many of them mentally, and it really colors, I think, your perceptions of the world.
Right,
and I think that's what's happened with the sheriff's department.
After 5 years, mm-hmm. if that's the world you've been in,
right,
you must have a pretty jaundiced view of humanity.
Exactly right.
Oh, God. Well, look, you know, this report that I was just telling you about from the Police Executive Research Forum that's just come out, one of the recommendations, or at least the statements from its chief executive, is officers spend much less time learning the importance of de-escalation tactics and crisis intervention strategies for dealing with mentally ill persons, homeless persons, and other challenging situations. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the ratio of how much police are basically dealing with mentally ill and homeless people, which should not be their portfolio.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. The police are, by nature and by job description, about control. That's what they're about. They're about control. They are least psychologically prepared to deal with people who might have who are smelling, who are mentally ill, who have been dehumanized to such an extent that you don't even want to touch them. Though and they have nothing but really contempt for homeless people. So they are the least able people to be doing that, and yet they're doing it because they are the last resort. Because in a place like Los Angeles, the powers that be refuse to look at the data, to look at all the innovations about how to deal with the homeless and what's most effective with dealing with them, and spend the money to do it. And so the police get left to do this, and inevitably it turns out badly.
But to some extent, you can blame Ronald Reagan, can't you? When he was governor here, they essentially, in the name of civil liberties, they emptied the asylums of people under the rubric that somehow their civil rights are being violated for their being in these institutions in the first place.
Right, but I don't blame Reagan, because that movement happened all over the country, and
right.
And it really was at that time a very progressive movement. Because people were being put in mental institutions that weren't mentally ill,
right.
And kept there,
yeah.
when they could have been released.
Right.
But what the second part of that movement was to erect small community places for the mentally ill that had to be housed and had to be watched, that couldn't just be out on the street. But they were never built,
right.
because we went into this fiscal austerity that we've been in for the last right. 40 years. And, things like that don't happen. So what we see are pitiful, poor, pitiful people who cannot fend for themselves for a multitude of reasons, just lying on the street. Just, if you go down in the heart of Los Angeles, in central Los Angeles, a lot of homeless are being gentrified out, but there's still a lot of people there. That, and so you don't want to go into that neighborhood.
Right. Within a few blocks of LAPD's headquarters.
That's right.
So just returning to the central, to my mind, one of the central problems with police is if you look next door at Mexico, mm-hmm. you don't want to call the police.
That's right.
You got to be scared of them. Because they're mostly criminals, and they're all about making money or taking bribes. And, the buzzword is a bullet or a bribe, lead or silver.
But one of the problems with policing in the United States and in Los Angeles is that people don't want to talk to the police either. They don't want to call the police, and they won't talk to the police because they don't trust the police. And what happens is when you have all of these homicides, the detectives go out there and they can't solve the cases because nobody in that neighborhood will tell them anything about what happened.
Why? Because of immigration or because of gangs? Or what is it?
Because they hate the police and they don't trust the police. And the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right.
And just because maybe that's great retaliation if somebody talks to the police in these mm-hmm. neighborhoods. But as a result of that, and the result of the way the police have treated them all these years, homicides just go unsolved. That's one ramification of the fact that people won't talk to the police in poor neighborhoods.
But just in the corruption issue in mm-hmm. general, where does that stand? We've talked about partial reform mm-hmm. in terms of just the wholesale killing of people, mm-hmm. which we've seen quite enough of. Where does that stand?
Well, it depends on what you mean by corruption. If you mean by corruption here in Los Angeles, cops on the take, I would argue that the Rampart scandal and Ray Perez were aberrations, that the average cop is not trying to sell cocaine or stealing it from the evidence locker, et cetera, and has not been with the LAPD ever since Parker, really. If you're talking about the kind of corruption which is violating the law, not holding police officers accountable when they abuse the public, shoot people that shouldn't be shot, and in general do things that they shouldn't do, that corruption is very, very strong, not just in the LAPD, but throughout throughout police departments across the nation. It's the it's circling the wagons. It's the blue wall of silence.
Well, just in closing, going back to Chuck Wexler, who I was quoting, the head of the Police Executive Research Forum, there seems to be some enlightenment going on there in terms of trying to say that, you know, we should find other ways to de-escalate situations rather than just pull a gun out and shoot. Like in the case of Tamir Rice, the guy arrives within seconds and he kills this teenager. It actually wasn't even a teenager. I think he was 12 years old.
Yeah, he was 11 years old.
11 or 12, yeah. So just in closing, where do we stand? Is that going to be the new direction?
Here's what I think. American policing in the early 90s had a reformation, okay? Prior to that, the way the police worked was to hear of a crime, somebody calls in and says, somebody's trying to break into my house. So they go over there and they respond to that crime. That was really ineffective. Bill Bratton in New York from 94 to 96 said, wait a minute, what about preventing crime? What about having solutions to crime that prevent crime, like hotspot policing and a number of other real advances that helped reduce crime in many places across the country? So that's been done. That's out there. But broken windows, mass broken windows, zero tolerance broken window policing remains, and that's a disaster. And stop and frisk for anything, like we were talking about that poor woman who didn't put on her signal, is still there. And police departments haven't begun to conceptualize how to meet the demands of the Black Lives Matter folks and others, and conceptualize a new way of policing that would be a second wave of reform. So that's what I'm waiting for. I'm not overly optimistic that it will happen, but I think if the Black Lives Matter folks and others, I mean, they've gotten Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders to essentially say, yes, we understand what you're saying, we're going to do something about it. I think if the Democrats win, that might be very useful.
Well, John Dominic, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian. I just love your show, and I think you're the best in L.A.
Oh, well, thank you, Joe. And I've been speaking with Joe Dominic here in studio. He's an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and the associate director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's the author of To Protect and Serve, the LAPD's Century of War in the City of Dreams, and Cruel Justice, Three Strikes, and the Politics of Crime in America's Golden State. His latest book just out is Blue, the LAPD and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.